Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the passionate speech President Obama delivered today to rebut yesterday's self-serving response to the Orlando tragedy by Donald Trump, in which Obama, without mentioning Trump's name, ridiculed the absurdity that using the phrase radical Islam would in any way deal with the threats that terrorists like ISIS pose to the United States. Lawrence Korb, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress who served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction, joins us to discuss Obama's furious takedown of Trump and Hillary Clinton's call to go after lone wolves. Then we'll look into a rare victory for the people over corporate power in a critical decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit that upheld net neutrality, meaning that telecom giants and cable monopolies will not be able to block or slow down internet content for consumers. Matt Wood, Policy Director at Free Press, joins us to discuss what this means for mobile and broadband service, which, had the ruling gone the other way, would get even worse than it is, ending up with the poverty of choice from paid prioritization of corporate content over consumer choice. But the fact remains that in spite of the internet having been invented in the United States, telecom and cable monopolies who control the pipe into the home charge customers much more for some of the worst services in the world compared to Japan, South Korea, and France, where high-speed broadband internet service is up to 100 times faster for one quarter of the cost. Then finally, we will examine today's Republican economic plan issued by Speaker Paul Ryan that is essentially a gift basket to corporate interests and powerful donors like the Koch brothers. Robert Weissman, the president of Public Citizen and the chair of the Coalition for Sensible Safeguards, joins us to describe Paul Ryan's agenda of rolling back science-based health, safety, consumer worker, and environmental protections while denying victims of corporate predators like investment advisors the right to seek redress in court. And joining us now is Lawrence Korb, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He served as Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in the Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Korb.
Nice to be with you again, Ian.
And Larry, today President Obama made, I think, one of his most impassioned speeches, certainly. It had echoes of the fury that he vented after the hideous Newtown massacre of young kindergarten kids in taking on Donald Trump and exploding this idea that Republicans and Trump have floated that somehow the Obama administration is crippled by political correctness and unable to use the words radical Islam. Obama said, what exactly would using this label accomplish? What exactly would it change? Would it make ISIL less committed to try to kill Americans? Would it bring in more allies? Is there a military strategy that is served by this? What's your reading on how this is going to play in the public, given that Trump made this disgustingly opportunistic speech yesterday, which might well have resonated with a lot of American people?
Well, I think it did, but at least initially. But I think if you listen to the president's speech today, the things that he pointed out are that rhetoric is not going to, you know, accomplish. You need a policy, and you don't want to have rhetoric that'll make it more difficult to accomplish your objectives. And I think that, you know, yesterday he basically, at first, you know, his comments were very measured, but then after Trump, he, you know, basically came out and explained why he did that. And unlike Trump, who, you know, showed no at all any type of maturity by reacting right away before all the facts were in and before we knew exactly, you know, what motivated this young man. And we now know it was much more complicated than just that oath that he gave to ISIS shortly before he was shot.
So is it the heart of the problem, though, here, that a lot of what Trump says, even though it's all over the place, he is hitting on certain nerves? And it seems to me that one of the things that really gets to people, I think, in this country, and I spoke yesterday to Rachel Kleinfeld, who was on the advisory board of the State Department, and she says in her travels around the country talking about national security, she was astounded at how many people spoke out against our broken immigration system. And when she brought this news back to her colleagues in the national security community, they sort of looked blankly at her and said, well, immigration doesn't have anything to do with national security. Do you think Trump is onto something here? Because there is, as Trump pointed out, there's a pattern. The bombers in Boston came in on a political asylum. The 19 hijackers came in on visas. There's so many evidence, so much, and the wife of the San Bernardino shooter came in on a visa, etc. Is he onto something, do you think?
Well, I think he's on to something with some people. And unfortunately, throughout our history, we, you know, one generation always as opposed to the next generation of immigrants who come from a different background, whether it was, you know, the English against the Irish and then the Germans against the Italians. So there's no doubt about the fact that there will be people who will be attracted to that. But I think when the dust settles, most people are going to say, well, you know, that's really not us. We are all, you know, immigrants. And this unfortunate person that, Omar, that just did this horrible thing down in Orlando, he is an American citizen. He's not an immigrant. And I think what, you know, Trump is also trying to exploit is that these folks are not sort of the majority Christian or Jewish people. You know, they're different. You know, they're Muslims. And so therefore, even if they're here legally, they shouldn't be here legally.
So in terms of the tone of Obama's speech today, which I say is, I think it was pretty clear that it was extremely angry. He never mentioned Trump by name, but there was a palpable measure of disgust in his voice. I think a lot of it's to do with the sort of disgust over Trump's response to the worst terror attack since 9/11, where he was clearly, you know, he had the perfunctory moment of silence, but then went on to basically toot his own horn. I was right and they're wrong, etc. Do you think that there's enough people in the country to recognize that that's in poor taste?
Well, I think there are enough. Not everybody will recognize that, but I think there are enough when, you know, people sort of step back from the heat of the moment. But, you know, it's interesting. A lot of Republican leaders denounced Trump yesterday with some of the things that he said about immigration, for example. Paul Ryan, Kevin McCarthy, you know, the leading Republicans in the House of Representatives. And I think that will go a long way toward undermining Trump.
The president himself castigated Republicans today in his speech at the Treasury Department, saying, where are they? You know, when are they going to step up and denounce this stuff?
So, well, I think that some of them did yesterday, not as many as you might like. You know, for example, Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, or some of the other candidates who ran against them, like, you know, Governor Bush or Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz, I think, you know, would certainly help.
So in terms then of Hillary Clinton, who, of course, Trump has gone after her on the with this idea that somehow they simply can't utter this word Islamic radicalism. And I think in an NPR interview it was a couple of days ago, Hillary Clinton put that to rest, but he, of course, went after her nevertheless in his speech. And he, believe it or not, he quoted an unnamed kind of Secret Service gossip about how she was unfit for the steward of national security. It just seems that this guy is just picking stuff out of the air, conspiracy theories. He seems to be sort of almost more informed by Alex Jones than he is by the normal kind of input that politicians get, which is by and large fact-based.
Well, there's no doubt about that. Many Republicans were hoping after he got the nomination that he, in fact, would act more reasonably or more presidentially and, you know, get the issues out here. But he's gone back to the same type of thing that he used during the Republican primary. Crooked Hillary now is in place of little Marco or Lion Ted, or, you know, talking about Senator Cruz not being an American citizen. I mean, that's the same type of card he's playing because he thinks it worked in the primary and it'll work in the election. He doesn't keep in mind that the number of votes he got in the primary was not even a majority of the Republican votes, and it's certainly not going to be the majority of people in the country who are not either Democrats or Republicans.
So turning to Hillary Clinton's suggestion that she would focus more on lone wolf terrorists, I'm not sure how that can be accomplished. First of all, to begin with, the fact that the FBI was in a very defensive mode at the press conference after the Orlando shooting because they had twice interviewed this killer of the 49 people down in Orlando, and that he was clearly on their radar, and somehow or other he slipped through the cracks and was able to buy guns. And there's been a lot of recriminations on both the issues of gun control and of national securities, in terms of this rather porous net that we have. But I think, and furthermore, I think it's pretty clear that in many ways, since 9/11, the restructuring of Homeland Security, etc., hasn't been particularly helpful because the FBI is by nature a law enforcement organization. It's not an intelligence agency. It's not. They do have some counterintelligence people, but they were largely focused on the Soviet Union spying here in the United States. But they simply are not equipped because their job is to solve crimes that have already been committed, not to prevent crimes that are about to take place. So let's start with that. Is that a fundamental problem that we have?
Well, I think Secretary Clinton was correct in pointing out the lone wolves, because if they're organized attacks like Al-Qaeda did, I think with the, you know, our intelligence agencies, now that we have a director of national intelligence, would be very, you know, well positioned to stop that. And with the drone strikes, you know, as these people begin planning them, we can get to them. What Secretary Clinton was saying is that we need to focus more on people who might be self-radicalized. In other words, we wouldn't pick up any messages between, ISIS and people here in the United States. These would be people who go on social media to become radicalized or might talk to their neighbors, or, you know, people might observe it. And that's what I think she means we have to focus on. And if you look at what ISIS is saying, in fact, that's what ISIS is saying, you know, ever since they started losing ground over there in the Middle East. Well, you know, you folks in, you know, other parts of the world come after those who are causing us problems, and you don't have to wait to get instructions from us. Just go ahead and do it. And I think that's what you were saying. And that seems to me, you know, a much different threat, because after 9/11, we got much better equipped to deal with the planned attacks that we could pick up, working with our own intelligence agencies and intelligence agencies in other countries.
But just in terms, I want to talk more about the lone wolf issue, but just in terms of the restructuring, is there a way to improve the FBI's intelligence just in terms of personnel? Because essentially, it is a law enforcement agency, and it's not proactive. Its job is they're used to solving crimes after they've been committed as opposed to preventing them before they happen.
Well, we've got 15 intelligence agencies. The FBI does have an intelligence component, and that's what you have to work with. And that has been beefed up ever since 9/11. And after that, we passed the law that set up a director of national intelligence. And so General Clapper can ensure that they get the training and they get the resources that they need to do this, other than the law enforcement, because he has, you know, a big input on their budget. And so that's really, you know, the way to do that. And people forget that we have these 15 intelligence agencies. For example, if Department of Energy has an intelligence component which focuses on, you know, people that might be trying to smuggle in atomic particles or some kind of nuclear materials.
Well, let's turn then to the other issue that I brought up. That's the lone wolf terrorists that this fellow's been categorized in, along with the Syed Rizwan Farooq out in San Bernardino, etc. The problem seems to be that how do you find that moment, that threshold, when somebody, you know, some sort of screwed up kid with psychological problems or family problems or whatever, spends a lot of time on the internet down in the basement looking at all kinds of weird websites. And that's a pathology across the board. And a lot of the non-political shooters that created massacres like it in the movie theater in Colorado fit that profile. But the key thing is, when does that person who's a little bit of a misfit on the internet all the time suddenly go from a loner and a loser into an assassin who, because of our non-existent gun control laws, can purchase high-powered military weapons and kill as many people as you could possibly do in the shortest period of time. So, first of all, how do you find that threshold? How could that be policed?
Well, again, you can't buy perfect security, and given, you know, our constitutional rights, the government has to be somewhat circumspect before the, you know, somewhat restrained in what they do. And I think you hit on one thing. There is anybody who might be suspected shouldn't be allowed to, you know, buy weapons. And certainly, as General McChrystal, you know, our former commander in Afghanistan, said, you know, the AR-18 that we use, that's for, you know, soldiers in war, not for, you know, citizens in the United States. And I think that's something we got to really take a look at, our gun control laws. People forget we had an assault weapons ban from 94 to 2004 when it expired. We need to renew that again.
Well, just so I guess what you're saying then, Larry Korb, in terms of this lone wolf idea of policing that moment where misfits become murderous radicals, you can't police people's thoughts, can you?
No, you can't. And, you know, there are a lot of people who fantasize and who are frustrated and, you know, say things, but they're just, we're more talk than action.
Well, just in closing then, President Obama, in his very passionate speech today denouncing Donald Trump without naming him, going after doubling down on his ban on Muslims, Obama said that this would eventually resort to treating Muslim Americans differently, subjecting them to extra surveillance and discriminating them based upon their religion. Where does that stop, he said. So that seems to be what we're heading towards here. And do you think that that's going to resonate in terms of, you know, a lot of people got upset with Edward Snowden's findings and, you know, supported the idea that the government shouldn't be going after citizens, but it's even worse when the government targets a particular group of citizens, surely.
Well, there's no doubt about it, and that's the problem that you have. Many times you overreact and you go too far in one way or the other, and after 9/11 with the Patriot Act and all of the things that Snowden revealed to us, we went too far. Now I think we may not have gone far enough, and we need to strike that balance. And that's why you need mature, responsible, you know, balanced, you know, leaders in the, you know, in all of the jobs in government, because it's a very hard line to walk, and you don't want to overreact, because once you do, it's too late to deal with it. You know, President Bush has gotten a lot of criticism for some of the things he's done, but if you look at what he did right after, 9/11, and he went, you know, he visited a mosque, and he said this is not a war against, you know, a religion or anything like that. I think that's the tone we need to continue to set.
Well, Lawrence Korb, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, thanks for having me. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Korb, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center of Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration as the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the rare victory of the people over powerful corporations with the net neutrality ruling.
yes, you have, girl. Don't you know you gotta tell the truth, yeah? Baby, why don't you tell me the truth now? You know you got me doing everything crazy that you want me to do. Get your hair, yeah, watch it.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Matt Wood, Policy Director at Free Press, where he helps shape efforts to protect the open internet, prevent media concentration, promote affordable broadband deployment, and safeguard press freedom. Previously, he worked as a public interest law firm, Media Access Project, and in the communications practice groups of two private law firms in Washington, D.C. And prior to that, he served as editor-in-chief for the Harvard Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Law Review and worked for PBS. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Wood.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And it's great to talk about something that's good news. Rarely does the public good win out over corporate power, but that appears to be the case in terms of this net neutrality ruling that came down from the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia on Tuesday.
It is indeed. It's great news. I was listening to the first line there of my overly long bio, and it says protecting the open internet, and that's really been one of our central missions here at Free Press. Dozens, if not hundreds, of other advocacy groups working on this same issue for the better part of a decade and more now. And the D.C. Circuit has affirmed and upheld the FCC's decision. The net neutrality rules themselves were rarely questioned in court, but they were thrown out several times because the courts said that the agency had done it wrong. The rules might be right, but the legal foundation for them was wrong. And this decision really sets the FCC on the right path, or I guess I should say recognizes that they got back to the right path by treating internet service providers as carriers and as communication services once again, and laying the foundation for these essential protections.
So in other words, they're treating the internet as a utility like the phone lines are, that nobody can discriminate about what goes over the phone lines, that they're just open access to everybody. Am I putting it in simple terms here?
That's basically right. You know, a lawyer like me will quibble over the term utility because it's not exactly right. And what the cable companies have tried to say is that so-called utility rules only apply to monopolies like a power company. Common carrier is another term that's probably less familiar to people and is slightly more accurate, but it's the same idea. It's this notion that the company that carries your speech shouldn't get to pick and choose what you say or who you talk to, and it is very much taking the rights that we all have with telephone calls and transferring them to the internet and locking them into place so that just as the phone company can't decide, we'd rather you call a different company because we have a deal with them. You know, neither can they do that with web browsing or emails or the applications that people use on their connection.
Well, this is obviously a blow to the big telecom monopolies and the cable monopolies, but I don't think there's any support in the country for the cable monopolies because everybody gets a cable bill. And the country that invented the internet has some of the worst, if not the worst, internet service in the world, and it gets worse and worse. And I notice now that Time Warner is advertising not so much about, you know, what kind of service you get and what kind of speed of the broadband is, but whether or not the guy that comes to your house will show up on time, mm-hmm. which is almost an admission of defeat. I mean, and then they brag about, you know, you can get a 40 megabit service. I mean, you know, South Korea, Japan, they have a gigabyte, 1,000 megabytes. I mean, Chattanooga, Tennessee, which is a local public utility, has 1,000 megabits. Santa Monica has introduced broadband, high speed broadband, and it has boomed for them. You know, all the companies are flocking to Santa Monica. It's just crazy. How did this happen? How did we get so far behind? As far as I can tell, the answer is pretty damn simple. This is what happened when corporate monopolies take over, and they just milk you dry and make as much money as they can by providing as less services as allowed.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to this legal foundation I was talking about, and it's funny because back in 1996 or throughout the mid-90s, before that law was adopted, a lot of consumer advocates for telecom issues would have said it was a bad idea. In hindsight, it looks like it was a brilliant idea to go the route that they went. It's just the FCC was never able to live up to it because they were on more of a losing streak in court for the better part of the last two decades. What I mean by all that is, you know, before 1996 and really before the mid-80s with the breakup of the Bell system, we had a lot of regulation of what was very clearly a monopoly telephone system. The gamble that the government took in the mid-80s through mid-90s was that competition would work better than regulation. But thanks to successful legal and lobbying strategy from cable and telephone companies, we've really had neither for the last decade or more. You know, neither strong regulation nor effective competition. And what we see is not only places like Chattanooga and Santa Monica and some cities or their utilities that they have, their power companies, going it on their own and providing a much faster speed gigabit or higher level connection at a lower price. But also in a few cases, you know, Comcast or AT&T doing that, only in response, though, to the spur of Google Fiber arriving in town or one of these municipal utility companies rolling out service. So, you know, we've seen that the cable plant, the wires in the ground today are capable of these high speeds and more. It's just that mysteriously they don't turn it up to that speed and do so at an affordable price until they are faced with a competitive threat. And that's what we have to do going forward. We have to make sure that we have either effective competition or regulation when and where this is, in fact, a monopoly service, not the case that we've had for the last two decades, which is neither of those two. And as you so rightly said, users suffering speeds that are getting better over the course of those decades, but not getting better fast enough or as fast as we've seen in some other countries.
Well, my understanding is that the national average is 9 megabytes per second. Is that right?
Yeah, it's close. It depends on what you count. You know, wireless is getting faster itself. So, again, I wouldn't want to overstate it. I mean, service today is better than it was a decade ago and better than it was two decades ago. But the question always is, are people really benefiting from the advances in technology? Is it affordable? Or are the cable and phone companies using that monopoly and market power that you're rightly identifying and only trickling out upgrades and charging too much for them? We certainly think that's been the case. You know, generally, the arc is better. Computers are faster today. Connections are faster. But we should be experiencing even better if we had real competition and real public interest oversight truly helping to unlock the power that these networks have in some cities in the U.S., in some countries overseas, but not uniformly enough by any stretch yet here in this country.
So not only do these cable monopolies and telecom monopolies try and give you the worst possible service for as much money as they can wring out of you because you don't have much choice, no choice, in fact, by and large. We went from having Time Warner, and then they got into a battle with CBS and basically cut off CBS, and it was like, we, the consumer, felt like collateral damage to some corporate showdown between these sort of corporate fraternity boys duking it out at our expense. So we switched to DirecTV satellite, and it doesn't have particularly good service. And now thinking of going back to Time Warner, which is just horrible because they're so horrible. This is the kind, I'm just telling you my own personal experience here. But I understand these people, you know, like the telecoms, preemptively sue states and municipalities to prevent them from doing what Chattanooga has done, which is to offer up high-speed broadband as a public utility.
Yeah, they don't always even have to sue because the other thing that especially the historical phone companies have is an incredibly deep roster of connections and contacts and lobbyists at the state house level. So we see this across not the political spectrum, really, on one side of the political spectrum, but across a number of issues where if people think that Congress is dysfunctional and not progressive enough, take a look at the State House and you really see just how much power companies can wield there with an even lower dollar investment because state house races are that much cheaper. So we've seen some truly awful, you know, there's famous legal cases talking about states as the laboratories of democracy. We've seen some experiments go awfully awry here in the last few decades, and certainly on the telecom and broadband side, the same holds true because some states just outright prevent that kind of municipal investment in broadband infrastructure, and the companies don't even have to go to court. They have laws on the books that say that can't happen here.
And again, for reasons which I find mystifying, the public doesn't seem to understand the extent to which they're getting shafted. Because from any kind of cursory poll that I've done, I don't think anybody's happy with the status quo and with their cable companies.
Well, yeah, and certainly not to toot our own horn too much, but that's why groups like ours exist. You know, I think a lot of people have come to expect that cable service is bad, and you rightly say, you know, cable is very unpopular. That's why I laugh somewhat when they say, oh, no, they want to treat us like utilities. What I often say is nobody really hates their electric company until the lights go off. People have a full-time job hating cable, more or less, and that's for good reason. Cable has bad customer service and high prices, and that's not a good combination. Having said all that, what I think people sometimes say is, well, what can I do about it? And it's just a fact of life. And groups like Free Press and many of our allies in this space try to give an organizing vehicle and a voice to people who are rightly fed up and want to take action at the federal and state and local policy level to try to make things better.
So we've talked about the bad guys in this, the telecoms and the cable companies. So on the other side that clearly was able to sway the argument are some of the big, these are the defenders of net neutrality, not only the Internet Association, which is the trade group that represents Google, Facebook, Twitter, and other companies, but I guess groups like yours as well were weighing in heavily. My understanding is that Google is one of the most rich and powerful countries on the planet, that its market value is something like 10 times of ExxonMobil. It's a massively, massively rich company. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, it definitely is. And I think the interesting part of this fight is that Google was actually much more involved in the net neutrality debate in the previous round, so circa 2009 and 10. They were still weighing in here occasionally and certainly at key moments, but a lot of those internet giants, while they certainly benefit from rules that keep the internet open and keep Comcast and AT&T and Time Warner Cable from choking off access to certain sites or certain portions of the internet, they certainly stand to benefit from those kinds of rules, but they weren't really very vocal, and they chose in this round to be a little bit more behind the scenes or even altogether absent sometimes. And that makes, I think, the victory of people being organized by advocacy groups and companies and some of these somewhat smaller internet companies, it makes it even more remarkable that we were able to turn the tide and have this victory over a very well-entrenched cable and wireless and telephone lobby here in Washington, D.C.
Well, I understand that the one visitor who's visited the White House more than anybody else is Eric Schmidt from Google. So what's your sense of what those discussions with Obama are about, whether they were about protecting net neutrality, or will, because Google is so powerful, do you think at the end of the day, if they start wiring up cities, which is what they're starting to do, that they'll end up being yet another monopoly?
Well, I don't know if they'll be a monopoly just yet. I don't think they'll drive anyone else out of business. I think that is one key point, though, is that Google Fiber, which is in Kansas City and going to places like Austin and some other cities, these rules apply to them when they're providing the connection. So Google is not let off the hook, despite what people might have seen. It's just when they're providing a search engine, that's different from when they're providing the wire that connects you to the entire internet. I've seen those stories about Eric Schmidt going to the White House. I don't think that's a good thing in any sense. And I know, I would say for Comcast, too, you know, they've raised a ton of money for President Obama. He was joking with one of the top lobbyists at Comcast about, I can't even count how many times I've been here for dinner to your house, David, just a few years ago. And, you know, sometimes, luckily enough, when you have these clashes of titans, we can get good public policy that lines up with real people's interests. But, you know, we're on guard here for Google or for Comcast or anybody else having too much influence either at the White House or in Congress or at the FCC. We can't always stop it, but we can always shine a light on it. And, you know, as I said, these rules definitely tend to benefit the internet companies more than the internet service providers. But everybody today is an internet company, so it's not just the Googles. It's the, you know, the small companies, small businesses around the country who rely on the internet, and hundreds of millions of people in this country, not to mention billions around the world, who rely on internet connections. So I think this ruling is actually very pro-business. Cable and phone companies are big businesses, but they're by no means the only businesses, and the vast majority of business relies on internet connections that are open to them so they can reach their customers.
Well, I think history will make it pretty clear that possibly the worst head of the FCC was Michael Powell, Secretary of State Colin Powell's son, who was the guy that basically couldn't give away enough. He tried to give away everything to the big, powerful companies and spent a lot of his tenure flying around in Warner Brothers jet. And now I think he's the head of the cable and telecom lobby. And then on the other side, you've got Tom Wheeler, the current FCC chair, who's made this extraordinary user-friendly, public interest-friendly decision. He comes out of that same job that Michael Powell has now, and there was an expectation that he would rule in favor of the very people he used to represent, but he didn't. He ruled the opposite direction. So what happened to Tom Wheeler?
You know, there's been a lot of stories written about his past, and it's interesting. I don't know if there's any simple answer. I think one thing I would say is that, yes, it's funny and notable that, in a sense, although separated by a decade or more, he and Michael Powell, the current head of the cable lobby, just switched jobs at some point. And one went from being the head of the FCC to running the cable lobby, and Wheeler went in the opposite direction. Now, when Wheeler was running the cable lobby, it was 1979 through 84, if I'm not getting those years wrong. And then he was a wireless lobbyist after that. And, you know, I wouldn't go too far to say that this mythology of his time there was entirely true, but it's certainly largely true that when Wheeler was running the cable lobby, cable really was more of an innovator, or at least of an underdog and a new entrant itself, and was fighting the broadcasters who had a lot more power than cable had at that point in time, either politically or in the market. So, you know, Chairman Wheeler has said, well, he's always been about disruption and innovation, and at one point the cable companies were more technological disruptors rather than entrenched incumbents. I think that's part of it. I think the order of operations may matter. You know, another thing people said about Chairman Wheeler, and it's largely been proven to be right, is that he is willing to fight, and as somebody who is likely closer to the end of his career than the middle, he's able to take these kinds of decisions and to stand up and fight when he feels like that's the best thing to do. So it's, I don't know if it's his political cliche and saying has as much currency today as it did a few decades ago, but, you know, the people used to say only Nixon can go to China. Well, maybe only a former cable lobbyist can really truly stand up to the cable lobby sometimes and say, no, you've crossed the line and we need to reset the balance here and make sure that you're actually not taking too much power over what people can see and say online.
Well, Matt Wood, I thank you for joining us on this very joyous and optimistic day. Again, it's very rare that one can report good news, and this is certainly good news that there's been a ruling in favor of the people over the monopolies, and I thank you for joining us.
No, thank you so much. It's now the job is to keep the victory in place and keep fighting off any new attacks, but it's a great day for sure.
And again, I've been speaking with Matt Wood, his policy director at Free Press, where he helps shape efforts to protect the open internet, prevent media concentration, promote affordable broadband deployment, and safeguard press freedom. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking to Paul Ryan and the Republicans' new economic plan that is a gift bag for corporate America.
When the world that gonna be
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Weissman, who is the president of Public Citizen and chair of the Coalition for Sensible Safeguards. He's an expert on economics, healthcare, trade and globalization, intellectual property and regulatory policy, and issues related to financial accountability and corporate responsibility. He's written extensively on corporate accountability, access to medicines, corporate influence over the political process, the World Trade Organization, and regulation of the financial markets. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Weissman.
It's great to be with you, Ian.
And I've always been puzzled to the point of absolutely mystified that somehow Paul Ryan is seen as this kind of great policy wonk, and it gets a very, I think, a very kid-glove treatment in the press in that regard. It's almost an assumption that he's kind of a good guy trying to regulate a bunch of crazy Tea Party radicals. But I don't, frankly, when the rubber meets the road in terms of the policies that he's putting forth, there's no distance between him and the farthest right-wing fringe of his own party. I mean, a perfect example is that the Republicans are fighting against regulations that would make people on Wall Street who handle retirement accounts for millions and millions of American seniors, that they would not be required to act in the fiduciary interest of their clients. In other words, to basically do the right thing by the people whose retirement funds they're handling and investing. And instead, they're fighting on behalf of these Wall Street people who want to be able to basically fleece their customers and pile on unnecessary fees. I mean, it's so unbelievably counterintuitive that I can't believe that the whole nation is not up in arms about this. So what explains this disconnect between the real agenda and this sort of public relations myth that we have out there, that these people are actually working in the interests of the American people?
Well, I'm afraid I cannot solve that riddle for you. I think the premise of the question is absolutely right. I think Paul Ryan has really worked hard to cultivate this image of a really serious guy, a real policy guy, someone who delves down into the numbers and is, driven by the data. And I think in general, there's absolutely no reason to think that's so. Today provides fresh evidence. Paul Ryan has led the introduction of a new House Republican economic policy package, called A Better Way. The entirety of the package, or virtually the entirety of the package, consists of two elements. One is making it almost impossible for the government to regulate corporations, and two is making it very difficult for victims of corporate wrongdoing to sue wrongdoers in court. The among the regulations that would be affected is the one that you're referencing, which is a very positive, relatively modest, but very positive initiative of the Obama administration to make sure that financial advisors actually act in the best interests of their clients and have a legal duty to do so. We know from the best data on this that because they don't have that legal duty right now, they push customers into bad investments that benefit the advisors and hurt the consumer and cost consumers $17 billion a year. So yes, if you were interested in advancing the public interest, you would support that regulation. If you're interested in advancing the Wall Street agenda, you would oppose that regulation. More generally, if you're interested in supporting the public interest in health, safety, clean air, a decent environment, averting catastrophic climate change, making the economy more secure, you would make sure that the government has robust rulemaking authority. But if you just wanted to pay back your corporate donors, you would oppose it. And it's plain enough from today's package where Paul Ryan stands. Now, why it is that the media don't report it that way, I'm not sure I can tell you.
Well, we've had some good news, though, today or yesterday. The appeals court in Washington, D.C. ruled in favor of net neutrality against the power of the telecoms and the cable monopolies. And I think that ruling had a lot to do with the fact that when the cable companies and the telecom monopolies tried to basically take over the internet through the court system and prevent people from having access to what they wanted to see rather than having it imposed on you, in other words, the cableization of the internet, people just got furious, and the FCC was blizzarded with complaints, and clearly they've acted in the public interest. So is that where the problem lies, that somehow because the press is so either lazy or too pro-corporate, that the public's not aware of how important these issues are? If you were able to let every person who has a retirement account know that the government or Obama administration was trying to pass a law that would actually protect their investments and make sure that the person handling them would do the right thing, you'd have a lot of people on your side, wouldn't you? So that is that where the problem lies, in simply in communications?
Well, it's part of it. I mean, the Paul Ryan thing may just be a mystery that can't be solved. But I think generally, you know, among other problems in the sort of political landscape, you're on something important. The media, it's hard to sort of hark back to pretend golden age of the media, but we're for sure not in it now. And the whatever once existed of serious investigative reporting and broader reporting on policy has really diminished, been replaced by horse race reporting and endless cycles of pundits repeating minor variations of what the other pundits are saying. A lot of important things go on in Washington, D.C. A lot of important things go on in state capitals around the country and city councils. Those issues typically don't get well reported. The net neutrality one that you're referencing is a good example. It's a good, you know, but it's an important example as a regulation in a lot of ways. One is, you're absolutely right. I mean, the people rose up around net neutrality. When we say the people, it's not just like a fraction of, you know, the political left. This was across the landscape. Americans of all political stripes had very clear views on this. It was also, it is also a regulation that is pro-competition. It's actually a pro-business regulation. It's just anti the interests of the companies that want to monopolize the internet to turn it into more of a cable model, as you say. And it's quite telling that the Republican package singles out net neutrality, something that they oppose, even though their own, you know, Republican voters overwhelmingly support it, even though the principles that they claim to advance of market competition would lead them to support it. What dictates their position is the campaign donors who oppose it.
So let's go through this House Republican plan that was economic plan that was issued today. It's a 57-page document which details a list of bills that the GOP would like to dismantle that have President Obama's signature reforms, including the Clean Power Plant, the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Act, etc. You mentioned net neutrality. Tell us more about what's in these proposals. I mean, it seems like a total kind of corporate lobbyists' wish list, a gift bag, if you will.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. They're referencing, I haven't counted, a dozen, probably more than a dozen separate pieces of legislation that individually and especially collectively aim to make it basically impossible for the government to regulate, to take any new action to control corporate behavior. One of the extreme bills, and again, it's one of well over a dozen bills that they're pushing in this package, would say that no government agency can adopt a significant regulation unless it's affirmatively approved within a very short time window by both houses of Congress. Well, you know, Congress can't do much more than pass the naming rights for post offices right now. And barely that. It's unimaginable that Congress would vote with no changes to uphold important regulations. It's just like saying you can't do it. And in fact, that is what it's saying. But that's just one of all kinds of hurdles that the legislation aims to impose on regulatory agencies that really just have the purpose of saying no more. It'll be just no more rulemaking. They also aim to prevent different kinds of executive action, including action through executive orders like the kind Obama has taken to provide some rights for immigrants, or to most recently establish that the North Carolina bathroom law violates civil rights protections. So they aim to block those kinds of measures, too. What it really means is that they want to try to bring government to a standstill. It means no more government action for clean air, clean water, safe food, no action to stop Wall Street predatory abuses or to roll back drug company price gouging, and on down the list. That is the objective, and the sum total of what their proposals would do in the regulatory front would achieve that. They've got some special elements in there on Wall Street reform, including to try to deal to overturn the rule that you were referencing, to make it safe for Wall Street to steal from Americans again. And then they add on some extra elements, having made clear that the government won't be able to control corporate behavior. They want to also prevent Americans who are injured by corporations from them suing for some kind of compensation. So they would adopt a number of measures to make it much harder for victims of corporate violence and wrongdoing to sue in court. That's the sum total of what they say is their economic agenda. It is quite a startling document.
Well, I think one has to admit, though, that the Republicans and the Koch brothers and others in corporate America have been very effective in portraying themselves, particularly the Koch brothers and others, as job creators. And they've also, I think, been effective in suggesting that regulation, which is necessary to protect the health and welfare of the American people, like the water you drink is not going to be like the water in Flint, Michigan, that the air you breathe is not going to kill you. These are fairly basic things, but they've managed to skirt them around by the idea that regulation equals job killing. And you can see what Trump is doing with the miners. You know, we're going to bring back dirty coal just to so you guys can have a job. I mean, it's sort of crazy in terms of the nature of capitalism or creative destruction, as it's often described. You know, in other words, you're protecting the people in the buggy whip business. As the automobiles are being created, you're basically going to subsidize the buggy whip business. So it doesn't make any sense. But my sense is that the problem is that the Democrats don't come up with alternatives. You know, Hillary Clinton got hosed when she went to West Virginia. Some, you know, very sort of right-wing Christian miner talked about how God had put the coal there for them to extract, and she didn't know quite how to handle it. And she's sort of loosely talked about, you know, finding other jobs. But shouldn't there be some real focus on the idea that there are some certain industries that just have to be phased out because of the effects on public health? But at the same time, maybe we should be focusing on how to reemploy people as well.
Well, I think one of the mistakes the Obama administration has made, particularly, is more the case in the first 6 years than in the last couple, but it's pervasive, has been to effectively accept the frame that the Koch brothers and the Republicans and the Chamber of Commerce have put forward, which you describe accurately, which is regulation imposes too many economic costs on society. And what, you know, of course, the administration doesn't accept that, but they take a version of it. They say, yeah, regulation imposes a lot of costs, but we're really mindful of costs. We're careful, and we're sure that the rules we're adopting, well, the benefits outweigh the costs. And in that regard, they've done a lot of important things. They've also failed to do a lot of important things or refused to do a lot of important things because they're so self-restrained as a result of accepting that framework. In fact, as you're suggesting, regulation doesn't just protect the environment and protect our health and safety and stop financial ripoffs, make their economy more secure, guarantee that people are not discriminated against. It doesn't just do all those things. It actually makes the economy stronger. And there's overwhelming evidence that that's true. regulation creates new jobs. Sometimes it's technology jobs. Some, as you say, you know, if you have to adopt a new technology to meet a new clean air standard, then there's jobs in the development of that technology, the manufacture of it, and installing it, and so on. You think about sort of the big picture things, like moving to deal with catastrophic climate change. There's enormous job creation potential and shifting away from the fossil fuel economy and moving to energy efficiency and installing solar panels and weatherizing houses. And there's secondary economic benefits by reducing the expenditures that we make on energy. So these are not really controversial arguments, but they aren't the claims that the Obama administration has made. I mean, they say some of those things, but they haven't really broken out of the framework that's been set by the Chamber of Commerce and the Republicans, and that's been a big problem. And if we can do that, if we can force that on the Democrats, then it's game-changing. Everybody can really see, because all those things make sense. They make sense because they're true. And we sort of explain things in a simple way to people, and I think the arguments against regulation, which are really arguments against imposing standards on corporations, they just fade away.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Robert Weissman, Paul Krugman had an article recently, an op-ed in the New York Times, suggesting that there wasn't really any difference between Paul Ryan and the Republicans and Donald Trump's kind of predatory capitalist practices exemplified by the ripoff of Trump University. It seems like what's happened today completely justifies and verifies what Paul Krugman was saying.
I think that's right. I mean, this is, we'll see if Trump adopts this. Maybe he really will. You know, who knows what Trump thinks. He has, in the last few weeks, said he aims to repeal Dodd-Frank. That's the totality of Wall Street reforms adopted after the financial crash. Said he wants to do away with climate change rules. So those are big pieces of recent achievements of the Obama administration. Whether he is actually as extreme in his policy agenda as Paul Ryan, I guess, remains to be seen. But this document today is just a comprehensive anti-regulation, deregulation, pro-corporate agenda that's just astounding. It would mean that government activity to control corporate wrongdoing comes to a standstill. That's not an exaggeration. That's just what these proposals in their totality would mean. It is about as extreme as you can get when it comes to dealing with corporate power.
Well, Robert Weissman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Weissman, who is the president of Public Citizen and the chair of the Coalition for Sensible Safeguards. He's an expert on economics, healthcare, trade and globalization, intellectual property and regulatory policy, and issues related to financial accountability and corporate responsibility. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.